From KCRW in Santa Barbara, this is the 805, stories from the Central Coast. I'm Larry Perel, in for Jonathan Bastian. Today on the show, chances are you've been to a party where someone has had a few too many drinks. What makes that person overdrink while others know their limits? One UCSB neuroscientist has a theory. Also, a landscape architect who helped create the Flight 93 Memorial Park in Pennsylvania after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He offers some advice and inspiration to people in Montecito, how to handle mixed feelings about how to remember last year's deadly mudslide. But first, we start with wildflowers. Birds are chirping, creeks are flowing, and flower buds are popping at the Santa Barbara Botanic Garden. With the official start of spring right around the corner, even the bees are happy. KCRW producer Catherine Barnes spent some time at the garden this week and met up with rare plant biologist Heather Schneider to learn more about what's already becoming an off-the-charts wildflower season.
Okay, so we're hearing a lot about this super bloom. We're seeing mountains full of orange poppies. They're blowing up our Instagram. What is a super bloom and why is it happening now?
Yeah, a super bloom is something that is usually pretty rare. It's kind of special that it's happening now, just 2 years after we had one in 2017. But it's a time when, for whatever reason, the conditions are just right for especially annual plants to bloom just in extreme numbers. So you get a ton of germination from the soil seed bank, and then you have these carpets of wildflowers, which are one of the things I think make California really special.
And we hear a lot about it in deserts in Anza Borrego and San Diego, Lake Elsinore, just east of LA. What about here along the Central Coast? Are we starting to see a super bloom here?
It will definitely be a good year, probably even a great year, but that kind of remains to be seen. We're just starting to see things pop around here.
What are you starting to see and what are you excited to see here in the Botanic Garden?
Poppies are just starting. We have blue dicks coming up, which are nice little pom-poms to look at. Up on Figaro Mountain Road, chocolate lilies have just started blooming, which are really special. I always love seeing them. They're kind of an upside-down bell that's brown. Shooting stars and baby blue eyes should be not far behind. And of course, we've had the waves of ceanothus blooming here in the garden and in the mountains. So usually we get a flush of the white-flowered ceanothus, and now we're moving on to the blue-flowered ceanothus, and it should just keep getting better.
So in addition to some of these more common wildflowers, you kind of specialize in these rare plants. What are some that you're starting to see or excited to see this year?
Oh, so many. A year like this, when we've had really good rain and especially the recent fires, create kind of a unique set of conditions that trigger germination for a lot of species, especially rare plants that might be waiting for really specific cues to germinate. We'll definitely be locally looking at a lot of Mariposa lilies and some of the rare ones like the late-flowered Mariposa or the Catalina Mariposa lily. Last year on the Franklin Trail, the Catalina Mariposa responded really well to the Thomas fire, and so I would expect to see another good bloom of those. Right here in the San Ynez Valley, we have a really rare plant called the San Ynez False Lupin that only occurs right in the San Ynez Mountains, kind of West Camino, East Camino Cielo, and that responds really well to fire, and so we're really excited to see how we might find a range expansion of this plant because we haven't had a fire in that area for some time, and so that would be in the Whittier Fire Burn.
Great, and you said it responds, some of these flowers respond well to fires. I've heard the term fire follower. What does that mean?
So plants respond to fire in a couple of different ways. Woody shrubs often have the ability to resprout after fire, but for a lot of annual plants, and especially fire followers, the seeds are made to last in the soil for decades or longer, and they're waiting for some specialized germination cue associated with fire. In some cases, it's heat that cracks that hard seed coat and lets water into the seed and wakes up that embryo. In other cases, it's the chemistry of smoke and ash from fire that really triggers that germination. So we have a lot of plants like big-flowered phacelia and fire poppy that you'll only see for the first few years after a fire. And then once that vegetation heals and the shrubby community comes back, they'll disappear until it burns again.
So we think a lot about destruction when it comes to fires, but it actually makes room and triggers some things underground to come up.
Absolutely. And our native plants are pretty well adapted to fire, and they know what to do. It'll be really amazing for people to see just how green the burn areas are already and all of the amazing blooms that'll come up.
And right now we're at the Pritzlaff Conservation Center, which is across the street from the main entrance to the Botanic Garden. Here you guys have this huge rare plant collection, and I'm also seeing a lot of flowers blooming and plants that are native to the Channel Islands. Is that right?
Correct. So the Pritzlaff Conservation Center is kind of our conservation hub. This is where our conservation and research department sits, and we do research from genes to ecosystems, and we spend a lot of time in the wildlands. The building is hugged by our conservation collection, which is rare plants from mostly the Central Coast, Baja California, and the Channel Islands. And then at the edge of the Pritzlaff, we have an island section that has Channel Islands and Baja Island plants represented, along with the beautiful view of the islands.
Can you point out some flowers blooming here that that you can see here at the garden? And then if you're not here, you have to go across the Santa Barbara Channel to see them at one of the islands.
Sure, yeah. We could go around
here.
This way, yeah. These are all rare plants on the island, so you may or may not see them, but one that's just starting to bloom here in our conservation collection is the island barberry, and this is a super, super rare plant that until the last year or so was only known from 5 individuals on Santa Cruz Island, and that was the extent of it in the wild and the whole world. The garden and the Nature Conservancy and the National Park Service and other partners have all been working together to conserve this plant. And we're starting to find more as we look harder, more individuals. But this is one that's just starting to bloom. It has these really beautiful yellow flowers, and then the fruits will be kind of like small little berries once it's done flowering. We also have, which should be blooming in the not-too-distant future, this Santa Cruz Island bushmallow, which is really beautiful. It has these pink cup-shaped flowers, and you can see that on Santa Cruz Island. And down at the end here, we have another mallow.
Oh, wow. So, look at these pink flowers. I love those.
Yeah, this is the Northern Island tree mallow, which is definitely one of the showier rare plants on the islands. It has these really big pink flowers with kind of purple stripes on them and white centers, and they're really beautiful. They were pretty hammered on the islands because you can see they have these nice, big, soft leaves, so they were really delicious to introduced herbivores. But we're starting to see them come back in some areas, and actually our genetics team here at the garden is doing some work to understand how the populations of this plant are related to each other on different islands. And what we're finding is that there is a lot of genetic diversity between the different islands. And so that's pretty neat.
Okay, so say you're going out on a hike here in Santa Barbara this weekend. Where can you go to get the most bang for your buck, as they say?
A really great one that's super accessible to people is Jesusita Trail. So that's one that I know a lot of us hike all the time and don't really think about what we're seeing. But for rare plants, the Santa Barbara honeysuckle occurs, especially near the front of the trail. It's just littered with it. It's sort of this vining plant with long, thin, opposite leaves. It's not blooming yet, but it's pretty special. It's common on that trail, but nowhere else really. We have Plummer's Baccharis, which is a rare relative of our common coyote brush, and that's growing on the trail kind of along the creek side. We have a rare scrub oak in Santa Barbara called Nuttall's Scrub Oak, and that occurs on the Jesusita Trail, as well as an even more rare oak hybrid that is a hybrid between that Nuttall's Scrub Oak and the Valley Oak, and that's one that is extremely uncommon. If you take a peek down the wet areas and kind of creek sides, you might see the rosettes of Humboldt lilies starting to come up. Those will bloom a little bit later, but
those are those really big guys, right?
Exactly. Yeah, this is a lily that can be 6 feet tall with orange flowers the size of your fist. And so they're just like so fun to see. If that doesn't spark joy in a person, I don't know what will. Also, if you want to take a little bit longer trip up to Fig Mountain, chocolate lilies are starting to bloom, as I mentioned, and Grass Mountain is just getting its first blush of early poppies, so that'll be an area to watch. And the lupins get really spectacular up there as well.
And if you want to drive a little bit further, where else would you recommend?
Yeah, if you want to drive a little bit farther, Carrizo Plain should have a really good year this year. we're just starting to see gold fields and hillside poppies blooming sort of along the edges of the monument off of the 58. But I expect that to have a really great showing because they've had so much rain. Soda Lake is full. There are some rare gold fields that occur right along the edge of Soda Lake that are really neat to see. So that'll definitely be a place to watch, probably for April.
And the Botanic Garden is open 7 days a week. This is kind of a good first spot to come maybe to speak with experts and actually see these plants up close and see the names of them and kind of get a feel for what people might see as they go hiking.
Absolutely. You can see we're really nestled in Mission Canyon here, so you see a lot of what you can see on the trails, but more accessible. The other exciting thing about the garden is that you can get a taste of all different ecosystems just in one place. So you can visit our desert section, you can see our meadow, you can go to the redwoods, and then you can come up to the Pritzlaff Conservation Center and get a taste of the islands. So you can really get a nice smattering of the biodiversity of California right here at the garden.
What are you going to be checking out this spring?
Everything. I'm going to be on the islands quite a bit. We have a big project working on rare plants on 7 of the 8 islands. And I'm also going to be in Carrizo and Monterey County and, of course, locally. So when I'm not working, I'll be just frolicking in wildflowers.
Well, happy almost spring and enjoy.
Thanks. Absolutely.
That was Heather Schneider, rare plant biologist at the Santa Barbara Botanic Garden. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
This is the 805. I'm Larry Perel in for Jonathan Bastian. As crews begin to install metal nets in the canyons above Montecito to prevent a future debris flow, the community is still trying to decide how to remember the last one, which killed 23 people in 2018. One person who understands the complicated and delicate nature of creating public memorials in scarred environments is landscape architect Thomas Waltz. Most notably, he and his team designed the Flight 93 Memorial Park in Pennsylvania after the 9/11 terrorist attack. Waltz visited Westmont College this week to offer some advice on how to rebuild, replant, and remember the mudslide. KCRW's Jonathan Bastian spoke with him ahead of the event.
You like to take devastating events and use them as an opportunity to think anew. And you know, one thing I wondered is, what are some of the questions that you ask yourself when you start redesigning a new space? Because these are places that are loaded with emotion, with history. So what are some of those questions?
I think when we approach a site that has suffered some tragic event, some appalling and cataclysmic event such as fire or flood or drought, the first question on my mind is what have been the ancient ecologies that shaped and protected that place for thousands of years? I mean, there have been climate extremes before now, but now we stand to confront them with ever more frequency. And our hope at Nelson Bird Waltz is to look carefully at the ecologies that shape that place to find clues in what might be the most resilient ecologies to build upon for the restoration of that landscape.
This is an area that frankly has, well, you could really say all of coastal Southern California that continues to burn. And oftentimes after a burn, as you're going to see in Montecito, you can get these devastating mud flows or mudslides. I don't know, when you think about that and you think just about how this landscape seems to burn and regenerate, I mean, where does that lead you? What other questions do you end up asking there?
Well, I think in that case, looking carefully at forest management and the removal of fuels over time, we've entered an era where we discourage any burning whatsoever. And in fact, the ecology that has shaped many forest ecologies and ecosystems across the United States over history has been one of managed fires, whether they're lightning strikes or managed by First Nations peoples or settlers. You actually burn out the ground plane, which is the fuel, as they call it in forestry, that can lead to devastating and cataclysmic fires. A regular regime of burning in certain ecologies can actually be quite healthy for a forest. It's when there's been no maintenance of a forest over decades that fuel builds up to have these devastating effects. Another complication, however, is urbanization. And that is a puzzle that I don't know how to solve. When you have highly urbanized areas still intermingled with forests, there isn't really that opportunity to maintain the ground plane. So we have to look to other means, either by cutting out the ground plane to reduce that fuel, maybe even reducing canopy. It's a very difficult balance.
You also have experience dealing with something tragic. I mean, I think, for example, of Flight 93 Memorial Park. This is a place in Pennsylvania that memorializes where a plane crashed. Some may remember during the 9/11 events when crew members
Correct.
Banded together. And you are stepping into an area of Montecito where 23 people have died because of a mudslide. And I wonder, what experiences do you take from Pennsylvania to share with Montecito? Also, frankly, with some people saying this is an outsider coming in, and some are even wary of the idea of doing anything or even having any kind of physical significance or reminder of what happened. It's a complicated situation.
It is a very complicated situation. But the project you highlight was that project was led by my former business partner, who's now retired, but Warren Bird led the Flight 93 Memorial. And I think that's an excellent precedent to highlight, because in that you are using the restoration of a damaged post-mining landscape, the restoration of grasslands and forest in this devastated landscape, as an analogy to the healing of a nation. The healing of the loss of a nation, in particular the families of the heroes who died in Flight 93. So this restoration ecology, in some ways, is a tremendous symbol to the loss that each of these people suffer. But within that, there's also hope. One of the things that Warren hit on in this memorial that I always think is so moving is that around the first week of September, you have the first frosts in the mountains of Pennsylvania. And so a half mile diameter of maple trees is planted to mark the site of the crash. And the first frost typically comes around early September. So around September 11th, all the trees go from their dark green summer foliage to scarlet red. So in a way, the site transforms, given that natural system, it transforms into mourning along with the people who remember that event. So I think in Santa Barbara, having beautiful symbolic reminders of loss is not just living with tragedy. It's looking for a symbol of hope to move forward. Hope is a really important emotion. And I think hope grounded in the authenticity of the place is the best we can ask for in design.
What happens in a case where you have some, I don't know, some indecision or maybe even unrest in the community in which they're not sure what they want? For example, I think a producer, Catherine Barnes, spoke with a therapist at one of the local hospitals who runs a survivors group for victims of the mudslides. And she mm-hmm. says this group is, for example, opposed to using rocks or boulders in the memorial. And actually, they don't really want to see a memorial at all. I mean, do these things ever come up? I mean, is this common in your type of work? Or do you only go to places where there is consensus of that we want something and we'll work within this framework?
You know, I'm a landscape architect, and we are invited into communities. And rarely, actually, is there consensus. When, you know, someone has invited us in, and what they've invited us to do is not show up with answers and telling everyone what to do, but they've invited us to bring our process, which is a process of listening carefully. And I think if people see that they're being heard, that changes the discourse. And then when they get to know you personally, they realize you're there in goodwill. You're there to offer the toolkit that you've formed as a landscape architect in service to the needs of that community. And when we lend that toolkit in service to an issue or a problem or a community, consensus starts to build. Now, it may not go where you thought it was going to go, and there often is not 100% consensus. But our process is one of looking so carefully at the ecology of a place and the culture that shaped it. The volatility starts to diminish. The anger starts to diminish. People feel that you are building a portrait of their community. And that often paves the way to a very successful solution, whether it's a public park or a site of memory.
Thomas Waltz is a landscape architect. Once again, thanks for your time and joining us on KCRW.
Jonathan, thank you.
This is the 805. I'm Larry Perel. At UC Santa Barbara, a team of researchers is trying to figure out what makes some people drink too much and other people stop before getting too drunk. Well, they have a theory, and it has to do with a mechanism inside your brain. Normally, that mechanism senses alcohol's negative effects and regulates your urge to drink. But when it doesn't work properly, you lose the ability to know or maybe feel when you've had enough. And so you might choose to, well, have another. Karen Zumlinski is a neuroscientist at UCSB and joins me now to talk about this new research and what it could mean. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, it's very nice to be here.
So binge drinking and more generally alcoholism is a complicated issue, right? There are many different reasons someone may overdrink, hereditary traits, issues in their past, maybe depression, and the list goes on and on. But you've discovered a new reason. Can you explain that to us?
So, well, it is absolutely true that alcoholism and even problem drinking in general is what we call a multifaceted disorder. There is interactions between genes and environmental factors. Family history, we know, is definitely playing a major role. And whether or not that's genes and environment together is really, really, really hard to figure out. And so this is one of the reasons why we use animal models, because we have control over a lot of these factors. And so for several years, I've been studying the glutamate system, which is one of the major excitatory transmitters in your brain. So this is what keeps you going and keeps your brain working and helps you think. And it's also very important in regulating control, which, of course, we know goes wrong in addiction. And we've been studying various different genes that change with alcohol exposure. And one of these is this Homer 2 protein. And often people actually call me the Homer lady because we've learned so much about this very interesting protein. And it turns out that alcohol increases the level of this protein. And one of those brain regions is the brain region we focused on in this particular study. This little guy called the bed nucleus of the stria terminalis, BNST. And the one thing we knew about the BNST is that it's very important in integrating information about emotions, particularly negative emotions, and turning those perceptions you have of something being threatening into behavior.
So for the majority of people, after a couple of drinks, we choose to stop. And that's because something is happening in our brain that's not happening in the brains of those who tend to drink heavily?
That is one possibility. So in fact, there's quite a bit of evidence from humans that even people with family who are not problem drinkers, but who have a family history of alcoholism, actually are less sensitive to the negative or aversive effects of not only alcohol, but other drugs that can block certain receptors in the brain. And so they will perceive the positive effects of alcohol, like the feeling of relaxation and maybe being a bit tipsy and a bit silly. But something is going on in the brain of people, whether it be genetic causes or because of alcohol drinking itself, that simply makes them less sensitive to these aversive effects.
Let's talk about this for a second. I want to play some tape from a UCSB grad student that we interviewed about this. His name is Raymond Borg, and he's a self-identified alcoholic. He's now been sober since 2011. Here's what he had to say.
When I first got drunk, it was just like a solution to all my problems. You know, it's just like everything kind of melted away. I was an overthinker, had a lot of anxiety, and so, drinking just like provided me an out.
And, you know, and when we asked him what made him pick up a second, third, and sometimes a fourth drink, here's what he had to say about that.
If one feels good, 12 is going to feel great, you know? Even if I was drunk, I'm still thinking about how can I sustain this? How can I increase this? How can I, you know, make sure that I can keep in this state as long as possible?
Now, you know, I know it's hard to pinpoint any one reason, but do you think the mechanism in his brain that's meant to regulate that urge to drink doesn't function properly?
Well, I would say so. I mean, I'm not a clinician. I'm a PhD, not an MD, and I'm not a clinical psychologist. But the fact that you know, we were talking about what would make him pick up one, two, or maybe three more drinks, and his answer was 12th drink. You know, this is well beyond even what an individual at a normal wedding or, you know, a happy hour after celebrating something would consume. And while we do develop tolerance, everyone will develop tolerance, there still is some level of intoxication. And it would appear that despite saying that he's drunk, it's all about maintaining the feeling. It's not about processing the negative consequences. How is he going to feel tomorrow when he has to go to school or he has to, you know, engage in some normal daily function? He's not going to be able to do it, but that's not what he's thinking about. He's thinking about that next drink and not getting that normal feedback that what you've had is too much, buddy. You need to stop now.
Let's talk a little bit more. He has another question actually about your research. We'll let him ask that as well.
Is it strictly looking at alcohol or what about like other mind-altering substances?
So while you're doing this research, did you find the same can be true about someone who smokes too much weed or does too much heroin?
So that is a very difficult question to answer right at this moment. And certainly my own research has really only started pursuing the BNST from an alcohol angle. But the interesting thing, and it's something that's probably going to take us a while to figure out, is this little region, although it's so small, has a bunch of sub-regions. They all talk to parts of the brain that are involved in addiction that we know from imaging studies and people aren't functioning well in an addicted individual. But precisely what aspect of addiction might be controlled by this little region versus that little region, we don't have a good grasp.
So if you know, like Raymond was alluding to, right, after 12 drinks, he's still like, how can I keep this thing going, right? So if you know that the mechanism isn't functioning properly in some people, is there a way to change that?
I think medically speaking, there may not be a way right now because the problem that we're faced with is this glutamate neurotransmitter is important for everything. It's important for normal thinking. It's important for memory. And so it's very hard to just hammer on that system with, say, taking a pill or something like that, because you're going to affect parts of your brain that are involved in memory. And we don't want to erase people's memories. We want them, we'd like to erase their drug memories, but it's hard to do that in a specific way. But then we can always take a step back, like in the case here. And if he knows, or if anyone knows, that they're just not getting that negative feedback, they're not getting that signal saying, whoa, you've had too much, then maybe they should start being more proactive in terms of counting the number of drinks they've had and knowing that this is a chronic relapsing disorder that's no different than depression or psychosis. This is something you're going to live with for the rest of your life. And then, you know, perhaps with seeking some therapy, we don't need drugs or something to reverse that glutamate system. Just with the assistance of a therapist and people surrounding you who care about your problem will help correct your thinking and exercising those parts of the brain that haven't been working well because of your drinking, getting them back online and getting those control mechanisms back in place. And that can be done with behavioral therapy.
Sure. You know, Raymond, I think, shares this as well. I think your thoughts on this. And like we said before, there are many reasons people abuse drugs and alcohol. He wanted to talk about that as well. So here's what he had to say.
There's like a deeper root to this stuff. And if you're not really fully addressing the deeper root, you're almost selling yourself short. You know, it's like, yeah, you might be able to take a pill and just like cope and like live. But like there's a lot more potential to be unlocked by like addressing deeper, kind of more like psychological, like less tangible things. You know what I mean?
You know, look, so you're a neuroscientist. You deal with a tangible thing that's called the brain that's full of intangible thoughts and feelings. And people, I think, still, as much as we have advanced in medicine and research, there's still so much that we don't know. How do you see your research fitting into all the deeper rooted issues Raymond is talking about?
We are very, very aware of these other sorts of psychological problems, and we actually try to model them in our animal models. What has that traumatic stress done to the brain of the animals that then might make them drink? And if we can figure that out, that would help our understanding, perhaps, of why people suffering from anxiety disorders, in particular PTSD is one that's very prevalent. Why are they drinking more? So we're hoping that as we move forward with this research, we'll start shedding new light on that interaction.
That was UCSB neuroscientist Karen Zumlinski, and you can find her newly released research on overdrinking in the Journal for Neuroscience. Thanks so much for speaking with us. Appreciate
Thank you
it.
So much for having me.
Well, that's it for today. You've been listening to the 805 Stories from the Central Coast on KCRW. You can learn more at kcrw.com/the805 or download the show wherever you get your podcasts. The show was produced by Catherine Barnes. I'm Larry Perrell, in for Jonathan Bastian. He'll be back with you next week.